From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. We sit down with the Washtenaw and Wayne County leaders to talk about mass transit from Detroit to Ann Arbor.
But I think very strongly the link between Detroit and Ann Arbor is a huge piece of it, and light rail to the airport, I think, is something this region significantly needs.
Why did the lieutenant in the Jackson County Sheriff's Office record his boss and then sue him?
I got the recordings, which were all done while at work, because I knew that the average person simply wouldn't believe it.
Whether Michigan's juvenile justice system works well depends on the county.
Right now, it's justice by geography, and I don't think that's a fair and equitable system.
Plus, we learned about Malcolm X's life as a child in Michigan.
A group called the Black Legion showed up at their house and burned their house down to make sure that they left.
Plus, a child care shortage means a shortage of workers in northern Michigan. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. This month, a lot of people in Jackson County were shocked by accusations that their sheriff, Stephen Rand, is, quote, a multifaceted bigot. That was among the complaints in a federal lawsuit filed against the sheriff. The sheriff has apologized for comments he made, but yesterday the Jackson County Board called for his resignation and added, if he doesn't resign, the governor should remove him. The man who filed that lawsuit is Tommy Schutte, a lieutenant in the Jackson County Sheriff's Department, and he joins us now. Keeping in mind, there's certain language we cannot use on the radio. What kinds of things has Sheriff Rand said that led you to file this suit?
Well, there were several things. Obviously, you know, I had witnessed it on personal behavior. It started back with I have severe hearing loss, and I had to step down from the SWAT team because of that. But he would make jokes with me all the time, referenced me as being mentally handicapped, talking to me in a disabled voice, and those are the things that I had put up with. Matter of fact, I went to a special needs luncheon right around October, put on by a local ISD, and he had sent a deputy, who was a school liaison deputy, text saying, I understand Schutte's going with you today. Make sure they don't mistake him for one of their own and put him on the wrong bus. This is one of many examples of the stuff he said to me.
This fairly mild compared to some of the things we heard on the recordings.
Correct.
You know, MLife posted this obscenity-filled recording of Rand making slurs against women, slurs against African-Americans, slurs against Hispanic people. Talk about imagining a pornographic film that ends in the murder of a court employee, a so-called snuff film. Why did you feel it was necessary to record him?
Because it wasn't just me. I started having, obviously, I was well respected amongst my peers and subordinates as their lieutenant. And so besides my own struggles and him making fun of me with my disabilities, I started having several people come forward in reference to concerns on his behavior towards them and the things he said. For example, I had a sergeant approach me. He couldn't believe the sheriff had made a comment about an African-American employee about stepping on their necks. I have also heard that comment made myself. But then I had a union board member approach me and advised me that while discussing with the sheriff referenced an ex-employee who was African-American, the union representative told me the sheriff made the comment that, well, at least that N-word won't be working here no more, or something along those lines. Now I've got other people, my subordinates, reporting this behavior. So that's where it started becoming, okay, it's not just me now. Now I've got a ethical and a moral responsibility to address some of these. So back to your original question, recordings. I didn't get the recordings just to hurry up and get out to the media for a smear campaign. But I got the recordings, which were all done while at work, because I knew that the average person simply wouldn't believe it unless they heard it for themselves. I mean, some of this, you know, people want to compare it to locker room talk, and we're not anywhere near a locker room, okay? These are staff meetings full of his subordinates. But I took the recording because I knew without them, people either couldn't comprehend the severity or the bizarreness of some of these comments, or they simply wouldn't believe it.
Before you filed the suit, and this all became on the record, you actually took these complaints and the recordings to the Jackson County Administrator and the Human Resources Director. How'd they react?
You're exactly right. That's why I did that. You know, obviously, look, I've had a long, great career. I've absolutely loved serving the people of Jackson County, So you can imagine there's a lot of sensitive information in there, and you know, nobody wants this embarrassment. And so I really wanted to give them an opportunity to deal with this internally. And per the policy and procedures, to report a hostile work environment, it spells out that it has to be reported to the county administrator, which is Mike Overton, and the human resource director, Richard Martinchek. So I set that meeting up, met with both those gentlemen. I told them about my own personal struggles of being made fun of on a daily basis after having my uniform taken from me, you know, the whole nine yards. But then I told them it was much deeper than this, and I explained to him his behavior. At that point, I played the tapes for him. And what I found odd was halfway through the tapes, I believe it was Martinchek, he had made the comment, we've heard enough, we're disgusted, which I kind of found odd because if you're human resource, you'd think you'd want to hear all the tapes if you're going to truly do something about it. But they cut me off short and said that they'd heard enough and that they would get back in touch with me. So 2 days later, I called Richard to see, hey, what's going on with this? And he informed me the county administrator, Mike Overton, went on vacation. And that while on vacation, he wanted a week to process the information. So I waited till he got back from vacation, and I called, left him a message, just looking for an update. And he refused to return a call, would not contact me. I called Richard. Richard refused to speak to me about it. All he wanted to do was talk about my long-term disability and that process. And I said, well, what about this very sensitive information I gave to you? And he completely blew me off, did not want to talk about it, and said that he didn't have any other information about what was going on.
Rand has been the Jackson County Sheriff for a while, and he's been at the department a long time, about 25 years. You've been there about 23 years?
I've got 20 years. I bought back 3 years, so 23 on the books.
Okay. So is this behavior, this language, a recent development? And if not, why hasn't somebody stepped up and said something before?
Well, that's a good question. You know, and it's tough to understand unless you work for Steve Rand or have worked for somebody like Steve Rand. Steve is the classic definition, I would say, as a bully. For example, in my position and other lieutenants, he will remind you that you are an at-will employee and that he will fire you anytime. You know, it's no different when I was in charge of the SWAT team. I knew my hearing had gotten worse to the point where I was a liability. I was a danger to my teammates along with myself.
This hearing loss, is this work-related?
Yes, it's the, you know, they sent me to a specialist and the specialist put on there most likely than not work-related sound exposure. I know what it's from. It's from the flashbangs, you know, because I passed the MCOLs, obviously, to get into the academy for my hearing. I passed a SWAT physical for my hearing, but obviously the years of flashbang use and stuff.
I didn't want to get you off your story, okay. But I just wanted to clear that up.
So, you know, but just like when I reported my hearing, when I wanted to step off the team, he would call me, you know, the P word, and he would threaten to demote me. He would ask if I wanted to go back on the road. He didn't want me stepping down because he wanted to stay in control. He wanted to be able to say that his sheriff lieutenant was running the SWAT team because we're a multi-jurisdictional SWAT team. I mean, we're made up of both city, police, and county. And he didn't want the city taken over. I mean, that's just my opinion. But I went ahead and did it anyways and reported it. And as soon as I reported it, they stripped me of my uniform, said I was a liability, and I could no longer carry an exposed gun or badge. And I did that for quite some time.
So we've heard the tapes and all these racial slurs and insults about women who are involved in the department or in the courts. Were there other things he demanded of employees, deputies?
Yes, he would constantly ask deputies about, you know, he would make sexual comments about other female deputies to them, and they were reporting this to me. This was the stuff being reported to me. But in one particular incident, a deputy who's an outstanding deputy, he came to me, and the sheriff was aware that he was having a relationship with another female employee. The sheriff began asking him questions about it, and then ultimately the sheriff ordered the deputy to see intimate photos of his girlfriend.
The sheriff wanted to look at them. Is that what you're saying?
The sheriff wanted to look.
And he ordered the deputy to show them.
Correct.
Wow.
So this deputy reported that to me. Again, this was all going on my shoulders here. Another issue was shortly before October, a longtime deputy, reported that he had heard a gunshot. He thought maybe somebody shot the sheriff because the detective's office is right down from the sheriff's office. He heard a gunshot. He goes down to inspect it. He looks in. He sees the secretary with a panicked look on his face. He can smell gunpowder. He walks in. And he describes seeing the sheriff standing in front of the secretary's desk holding a gun. And the secretary said he was playing with it and didn't realize it was loaded. And he shot a round just right in front of her desk. He had the detective take a piece of square carpeting, covered up, and that was it, never reported it. The deputy obviously has some ethics and integrity, came to me and said, listen to what happened. And so I told him, obviously, do a report on your own, give it to me, and on your own file. That way, you did the right thing in reporting it. But this is the type of behavior that people were reporting to me. And what's so frustrating was, is, you know, having taken this information and going to Mike Overton, the county administrator, and going to the human resource director, and they were more concerned whether they're going to save a dollar off an assurance for my hearing than they were about what these employees were going through. And I would hope, now since people know the truth, I was a lieutenant, people coming to me on top of my own disability discriminations, I had an ethical and moral and a legal obligation to report this.
Sheriff Rand says he does not intend to resign. How well is the department going to perform with this kind of cloud hanging overhead?
That's why I want to get the story out. You know, I think Sheriff Rand probably, even looking at the audios, he thinks it's just a one-on-one attack from me to him, and that's what I want to get out the truth, that that's not the case. You know, I put up with a lot from that man over the years, but once the deputies and even a couple other command officers, again, this isn't just me trying to smear Steve Rand. Am I upset with him? Absolutely I am. And he would be, you know, at this point in my career, to put up with his harassment that he thinks is funny. You know, that's the problem, right? Anything he does, he thinks is funny, and he demands a laugh, because if you don't laugh, you're no longer in his circle. But the biggest issue is several people reported wrongdoings to me. And once it involved other people, now I had deputies asking me, what have you done with it? Have you reported it? Well, obviously, I would hope anybody in my position, if they have subordinates or anybody else reporting wrongdoing, would do the ethical and the moral thing and report it. And that's what I did.
Tommy Schutte is a lieutenant in the Jackson County Sheriff's Department. He's filed a federal lawsuit against Sheriff Steve Rand, describing him as a multifaceted bigot. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
A few notes here. Sheriff Rand's office did not immediately respond to our interview request. On behalf of the Jackson County Administrator and the Human Resources Director, an attorney representing the county, emailed us a statement that reads in part, quote, "The county vehemently denies any wrongdoing associated with the events alleged in the lawsuit about the sheriff's office. Jackson County, through its policies, has publicly and systematically condemned the contemptible speech and conduct alleged in the lawsuit about the sheriff. Jackson County, like the public, is as shocked as anyone by these stunning allegations." End quote. You're listening to Statewide. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There is a child care shortage. That's not going to be a surprise to many families, especially those in rural areas. In a Dome magazine article, Ken Winter outlined the problem in northern Michigan. It's bad enough there that the Chamber of Commerce is in the region, Chambers of Commerce in the region are making it a priority issue. Joining me to discuss the child care shortage is Mary Manner. She is the Great Start Coordinator for the Venture North Funding and Development. How bad is the daycare shortage in your area?
Well, according to a study that we did last year, about 40% of the infants and toddlers in the region are without care while their parents are at work.
That's what I was reading. The most significant shortage is these infants or children still in diapers. Why that segment of children? What's so difficult about watching them? Or why do daycare centers not want to take them?
Well, as you might know, the state of Michigan expanded significantly its Great Start Readiness Program. We call it GSRP for short, by putting about $165 million into that program over the last few years to expand the slots for four-year-olds. So preschool is readily available to a lot more families than it was in the past. And the families up to 250% of poverty are able to have free preschool for their children, which is just phenomenal. But what that did is it left behind all of the children under the age of four, and in particular, left behind lots of infants and toddlers who are very expensive to care for because of the ratio of care. In a center-based setting, it's one adult to four infants, so it's very labor-intensive and hence very expensive for parents.
Well, the theory of a free market is if there's a demand, it will be met. Why is that not happening?
Yeah, I love talking about how the market, how the supply and demand is not operating in this particular situation. You have to understand something about the childcare model, I think, to appreciate the difficulty. So we're looking at a highly regulated business that is extremely labor intensive, that's very low pay, and that has no benefits associated with it and very little opportunity for an individual's advancement within the field. So who wants to do it? You know, we're really looking at people who care passionately about young children. Those are the people who are drawn to this work, and they're there because their hearts and minds are in it, not necessarily because they're there to earn a living and have a career. So how does the market operate in a situation like that? How do we draw highly qualified people into this work when we can't offer them wage and benefit package that they would be able to get even working in a fast food restaurant?
Ken Winter's article indicated that the lack of access to training for daycare personnel was part of the issues. As I understand it, some of the personnel at a daycare have to hold at least an associate's degree. Others have to be certified on an ongoing basis. How much of a problem is that really in being able to staff these positions?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to find people with the right qualifications. Most of our colleges and universities in the state offer some sort of early childhood development program. But again, the cost for educating yourself, the cost for acquiring those credentials, and the fact that you really have to do it on your own time because you don't have time off from work to attend class really limits people's availability. And the other thing is that with the expansion of GSRP, which I mentioned earlier, a lot of our highly qualified people are drawn into those programs, which are run in schools and selected community-based operators. So it really has decreased the pool of people available to provide quality care for our youngest children.
Let's look at the big picture for a second. What's the ultimate impact to a region if there's not enough daycare access?
People can't go to work. Someone has to take care of the babies. And the issue is that for quality, and I think we have to keep quality central to this conversation, for quality care, one of the things that we need is a consistent caregiver for that baby and that toddler. It's tremendously important for their development, both their cognitive development as well as their social, emotional, and their physical development. I mean, that little child is growing faster than at any other time in its life. And the brain is developing. And I know that people are pretty familiar with early childhood development issues. So we need to make sure that those children are in quality settings where the people who are caring for them are able to nurture and educate them throughout the day. When that's absent, then what choice do people have if they're passing their little infants around from one person to another, trying to cobble together enough care to be able to make it to work and constantly being concerned about the quality of the setting or whether a particular caregiver is available on a certain day? I mean, it affects worker attention, it affects their productivity, it affects their attendance at work.
Is this causing worker shortages or higher wages because of this shortage of daycare availability?
Well, it's definitely causing a shortage of skilled employees. I'm not really sure that we can say that it's having an impact on wages at this point.
What can be done to solve this problem?
Well, I think that we as a society need to spend some time thinking about what we want for our children and our families. And I think that we as a business community, we're dealing with a critical shortage that impacts our productivity, that impacts not just our bottom line, but our culture, you know, the culture in our businesses. And I think that there are a lot of really smart people out there who would be able to come together and look at this problem from some new ways and see how we might do a better job of supporting an environment in which we really prioritize worker satisfaction, worker engagement in the context of balancing that work-life.
As I mentioned at the top of the piece. The chambers of commerce in the region are making it a priority issue. How have business groups helped? What can they do, practically speaking?
Well, the first step, of course, is to understand the nature of the problem. And so I think that what we're really doing right now is exposing the challenges of providing quality childcare. And the first step in that is to understand what's the cost of quality. I think the second step is to really look at childcare as a small business that is a sector all on its own within our communities and begin to appreciate the challenges that our childcare providers have in operating their small businesses. Beyond that, I think that we're beginning to have some conversations with businesses about the potential for on-site childcare that is operated by local quality providers who might be opening satellite locations or second sites or attracting new people to operate quality care facilities within a business setting.
Mary Manner is Great Start Coordinator for Venture North Funding and Development. Thanks very much.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm so glad you're addressing this issue.
Governor Rick Snyder has suggested Michigan should restructure the state's juvenile justice system. Not much has been done yet. An advocate recently wrote an opinion piece in Bridge Magazine which indicated the youth and juvenile justice systems don't have the luxury of time. Paul Elam is the president of Public Policy Associates, and he specializes in juvenile justice. So what's wrong with Michigan's system?
Well, I think Michigan is very unique when you compare our state to the country. We have a few things that we need to deal with. First, we have juvenile justice that is administered by multiple counties. And in those counties, we have a public and a private system. And we also don't have the ability to gather data in a way to track the number of youth who are in those systems and the outcomes related to that. And so on any given day, when we ask questions about the problem of juvenile justice and delinquency, we really can't respond. And from a qualitative perspective, we also have evidence that many of the youth who come into contact with the current system due to their age, they're at increased risk for being physically and sexually abused. And we just don't believe that this is on the radar for many of our leaders in the state. We want to make sure that our gubernatorial candidates are aware of this, and we take this serious. I think every day that passes to sort of gather information and data that allows youth to languish in this system is a day that we just don't have. If it were my child who was in this system, I would not be accepting the conditions that they're actually being treated in.
Let's take some of these things you talked about point by point. You said counties are different. There are disparities from county to county, and you're saying kids are not being treated the same throughout the state. Can you give me an example?
Absolutely. So in our state, there's no requirement for every county to respond to certain behavior that's committed by youth county to county. So, for example, if I'm a first-time offender in Wayne County and maybe I get picked up for a truancy offense, if they have a diversion program and I'm eligible for that diversion program, I will be offered that opportunity, and the treatment, the programs, and ultimately the outcomes that I have will differ from a county kid in another county who may have committed the exact same offense, but they don't have a diversion program, and that kid might be sent through a formal adjudication process, and the result for that kid might be something that never comes off of their record if it's sort of a felony offense. And so right now, we just define that as sort of unfair justice. It's justice by geography, and I don't think that's a fair and equitable system. The governor called for every county to have that type of option in place for youth who come into contact with the justice system. And at this point, we have not realized that as a state.
Well, let me ask a follow-up to that. If these cash-strapped counties are still directly responsible for the juvenile justice system, what's the incentive for them to change? Or what should the incentive be?
Well, that's a great question. I think from my understanding, the time that has been spent this year is trying to ferret that out. What does the cost mean for counties if we're going to move, for example, in this debate, 17-year-olds from the adult system to the county system. And by the way, that recommendation is based on evidence-based practice research that tells us that youth need to be placed in facilities that provide programs that are appropriate for their developmental needs. When we look at the outcomes of those kids, they do better. They lack collateral consequences down the road that prohibit them from moving on in their life, and they're less likely to be abused or neglected. And so when we look at the cost, we definitely need to do that. But my argument is, if we know a system is ineffective and it causes harm, we should still have an intermediate or short-term solution until we deal with this long-term solution of what the cost is. Obviously, if this proposal passes, youth who are currently in the adult system, the state pays for that, will be moved to the county system. And I think the counties are saying we need to understand that the resources to treat these youth will also be coming. And so I think that's a fair argument, but it shouldn't take us years to deal with this. We're one of five states who have not made it happen. And I think we have the leadership in place. My piece identified those who were responsible for pulling this together. And we don't see any effort at this point to bring those groups together collaboratively, bring the best minds together in our country and our state and say, we need to get this done.
You mentioned data and keeping track of what's going on in the state. You write that the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services is responsible for oversight and funding for the juvenile justice services. They don't keep that kind of data?
Yeah, so another great question. I don't think the average citizen realizes that our public juvenile justice system has been dismantled right before our face. And many of the youth who once resided in public facilities in our state, who became wards of the state and their cases were managed by the state, that no longer exists. Most of our youth are being dealt with in county facilities. Judges make decisions about those particular cases. And many of the facilities the youth end up in are private facilities. I can't quote the number off the top of my head, but I would bet that 80 to 85% of our youth are in private facilities at the local level, and they're not under the jurisdiction of the state. The reason I can't quote that number is because we can't gather that information because we have a privatized system. And I know the state will tell you actually how many kids they have in place. We reduced the number of public facilities from over 10 to just about 3 at this point. And those facilities are for our hardest to serve youth who have severe and persistent issues around mental health and delinquency. And so we have to do a better job in trying to aggregate data from these private, public, local facilities throughout our state and roll it up to one entity that can report out on this particular issue. And the reason I know is Public Policy Associates has worked as a contractor for the state for the last 10 years to gather data like that. And we continually hear feedback from our local counties that the data we gather are inaccurate, even though the data comes directly from those counties due to technology problems that they have with their systems that have been implemented.
So you've made some recommendations to the legislature, this governor, the following governor, and the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. I'm wondering, is there a model county in Michigan or a model state on which Michigan could look to design its reform of the juvenile justice system?
Yeah, concerning our local counties, I think we have several counties who are doing great work in our state. Now, I won't call out any to sort of highlight them. I think
they can
come forth.
Why not tell us?
Well, I think I would like those stakeholders to speak towards it. But what I do know, or leaders to speak towards it, what I do know is there are models in our state. The problem is to replicate the models that are taking place in certain counties require a type of leadership, a type of investment, the ability to implement evidence-based practice and data collection measures. And it's not as simple as folks might believe. You know, to implement a data collection system, it might require an investment of over $1 million. And the cash-strapped times we live in, without new policy put in place, without the resources put in place, we obviously had a Headley Amendment. We can't just tell counties to put these solutions in place without the legislation and resources that are taken. I think in these counties, you will see that they've come up with ways to generate local revenue. They've come up with ways to be creative, and it requires us to roll our sleeves up and have conversations. I think on a national basis, There are a couple of states. I think we've looked at Pennsylvania as a state, but I think Michigan is a different entity based on the issues I just talked about. Most states have not created a juvenile justice system that's decentralized, public and private, and local decision making is spread out across all of our counties. And I think to address these issues, we will have to come to the table and come up with a new model, a new solution that will require some policy changes and investment in our youth. We did work on the Michigan Prisoner Reentry Initiative the last 10 years, and I think the public's aware that we spend about $35,000 to incarcerate adults in our criminal justice system. I don't think the public's aware that we spend about $100,000 per kid to keep them incarcerated in our juvenile justice system. And that number is growing. And we need to bring this issue to the forefront. Every dollar we spend on incarceration for our juveniles, many who shouldn't be in the system, is a dollar we don't have to spend on education, roads, and the like. And as a citizen here in Michigan, I think we should have some leadership discussing this issue.
Paul Elam is the president of Public Policy Associates. We've been talking about reforms in Michigan's juvenile justice system. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to come in and share on this topic.
Coming up, we learn about Malcolm X's life as a child in Michigan. Plus, we talk to two county leaders about Detroit Metro Mass Transit. That's after the break, here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Well, it's Wednesday. Let's talk about some Michigan history.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
You might have recognized that last voice in that intro. It's Malcolm X. A lot of you might know that he grew up in Michigan, but beyond that, it's a little fuzzy. Joining us to give a little more clarity is the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Rachel, Malcolm X, or as a child, Malcolm Little, was born in Nebraska. What brought his family to Michigan?
When he was in Nebraska, his father was preaching the sort of the word of Marcus Garvey in this idea that African Americans in America will never be welcome or equal to whites, and so they should find a place for themselves back in Africa. And that was not seen very well by the people of Omaha. And so the KKK actually showed up at his house and sort of forced the Littles out, and they moved. They moved to Minnesota first for a short period of time, and then by 1927, they ended up in Lansing, most likely to follow work, which was happening with a lot of people at that time.
And Malcolm X's family, not really welcomed by the white people in Lansing either. What happened?
No, they weren't. The first place where they ended up was in a neighborhood in North Lansing. If people are familiar with the city, it's off Grand River by the airport. But in 1929, the land company that owned that neighborhood took Earl Little to court, stating that only Caucasians could live there. So the courts ruled in favor of the land company and evicted the Littles. So after that, actually, a group called the Black Legion showed up at their house and burned their house down to make sure that they left. So after that, they moved right on the Lansing-East Lansing border. But East Lansing at that time was not particularly friendly to black people. There are some speculations that East Lansing was a sundown town, which means that if you are not white, you need to leave the town by sundown. And so finally, Earl Little built a house for his family. At the time, it was out in the country. It was on Logan Street, which is now Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
His father was killed on Michigan Avenue. In fact, if you know where the Green Door is, it's right about that location. Allegedly struck by a streetcar. I say allegedly because some people believe he might have been murdered. That event, the loss of the Little family's father, was devastating for the family. What happened to everyone?
They stayed together for a little bit, but by 1939, Louise Little, Malcolm's mother, she suffers a breakdown and is committed to Kalamazoo State Hospital. So Malcolm and his siblings, they do stay together for a little bit. Malcolm lives with family and friends, but he starts to get into trouble, and he's eventually kicked out of West Junior High School in Lansing, and the state takes over. So he is sent to the Ingham County Detention Home, which is in Mason, a town about 10 miles south of Lansing. And he lives there with the Swerline family. And it's called a detention home, but if you look sort of at historic accounts, it's essentially a foster home for kids who are waiting court dates to determine what's going to happen to them. So sometimes it's a situation where they are juvenile offenders, but then there are others. There's a four-year-old living in the house at the same time as Malcolm Little. And so there are basically just kids waiting court dates. And so Malcolm ends up living in Mason for a time. The Swerlines really like him. He's a very personable kid. He's a very smart kid. And Mrs. Swerline really sort of pushes for Malcolm to stay in Mason. And she arranges with another family, the Lyon family, for Malcolm to go move in with them. They are a black family. They live about a block away, and they have some boys that are about the same age as Malcolm. So they decide that rather than the detention home, the Lyons is a better fit for him.
He went to school in Mason. How did he do there?
He did very well. The students really received him well. He was on the football team. He was on the basketball team. He was elected class president. He's getting very good grades. He's very sociable. The adults in the community are a bit mixed. There's some very racist feelings toward Malcolm by some people. But overall, I think that the community sort of welcomes him. The students do, especially.
He eventually leaves Michigan. What happens to him?
After his eighth grade year, he moves in with his sister in Boston, and he spends some time there and gets sort of a new sense of a new place to live, but he starts getting into trouble, and a few years later, he ends up getting arrested and sent to prison in Massachusetts. And sort of this is where his story in sort of the public eye begins. Most people become more familiar with his story at this point in his life.
So what's been the legacy of Malcolm X as far as Lansing and Mason are concerned?
There's a historic marker on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard where the final house that the Little family lived in is. And there are people that still live in Mason that remember him and remember his time there. And so he is still remembered fondly as a very personable, very polite, very talented young man.
That's Rachel Clark from the Michigan History Center. Thanks for telling us about Malcolm X's life in Michigan.
Thank you so much.
You know, after Malcolm X became a leading spokesperson for the Nation of Islam and a nationally known civil rights activist, he still visited Michigan on occasion. In 1963, he was to give a speech at Michigan State University. Just prior to that speech, he met with reporters. Here's an excerpt of that news conference.
I believe you said before, sir, that you're working for an entirely separate way of living between the blacks and the whites, separated completely. By doing this, aren't you actually abandoning everything the Negroes ever worked for, racial equality?
I don't think black people want racial equality. Black people want equality. Equality has nothing to do with race. A man is equal whether there's another man around or not. And you, the black people in America who think in the present day way of thinking don't attach their equality or don't connect their equality with the white man. I don't want to be equal to a white man. I want equality. And my desire for equality has nothing whatsoever to do with the white man. I want equality whether there's a white man on earth or isn't a white man on earth. And this is a mistake that the white people make. By putting themselves up as the criteria and telling the black man, you're equal to me, or you are as good as I, and the white man himself is not the yardstick that you use today to measure equality, justice, or freedom, or anything else.
That's Malcolm X at Michigan State University. That recording is courtesy of the Vincent Voice Library at MSU. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. At one point, it appeared the leaders of Oakland, Macomb, Washtenaw, and Wayne counties, along with the city of Detroit, were on their way to supporting a ballot proposal this fall for a regional mass transit plan. Pardon the pun, but that got derailed when the county executives in Oakland and Macomb distanced themselves from it. Everyone seems to agree a four-county effort would be ideal, but probably unlikely at this point. So drop transit for the time being? Well, maybe not. Wayne County and Washtenaw County are still talking about transit improvements from Ann Arbor to Ypsilanti to Dearborn and into Detroit. Joining me to talk about that are Wayne County Executive Warren Evans and the Chair of the Washtenaw County Board of Commissioners, Andy LaBarre. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, how likely is it that this four-county plan for regional transit will be going forward at all?
If you ask me, the four-county plan, I certainly wouldn't bet the family farm on it right now, but we're still plugging away at trying to get Oakland, basically, to come back to what we thought the original agreement was, that there would be a horizontal line through Oakland County somewhere, and north of that would be their opt-out, and below that would be the people who would be voting for it. We thought that's where it was going, but that kind of got derailed.
Yeah, the county executive, L. Brooks Patterson, there kind of blindsided you all, didn't he?
Well, I was sitting in the second row when he had his state of the county. I certainly knew that he had kind of changed his tune about, you know, the horizontal line, but I didn't know he was going to be quite so strident at the meeting. I've known Brooks a long time. I have respect for him, but, you know, I just think he's wrong on this issue.
Yeah, Mr. Evans has far more eloquence and grace in that answer. I came out of that principals meeting about a month ago, Lester, and when I saw the comments from Mr. Patterson, they were the antithesis of both the substance and sentiment of that meeting. So it was a big surprise, and he's certainly welcome to his own opinion. I think he's fighting the pull of the future here, and I think it's a fundamental misreading of both the policy and the politics. But if nothing else, it was certainly a surprise, and had we known that, we could have had an additional 3 weeks or whatever to work on something else. And I'm hopeful the RTA can at least put a plan up and say, here's a solid transit plan that you have asked us as an entity to put together. If you want to vote against it, you can make that policy choice. But at least know here's a substantive plan that would achieve the outcomes you want.
And of course, Mark Hackle in Macomb County also says that, you know, I guess he's concerned about return on investment, that maybe he's not going to get they're going to be paying more taxes than they'll get value out of an expanded transit system.
Well, I mean, I think that's a little disingenuous in that a requirement built in it is that 85% of the dollars from each county are reinvested in that county. And so it's not, you know, the taxation of other counties to support Detroit, which is always kind of the hidden let's not talk about thing. 85% of it goes there, and the enhanced plan is significantly different than the plan that lost in 2016. And I think Andy made a very solid point there that it's somebody needs to be able to look at the plan. I'd like to see the RTA board look at it, vote on it, and let people understand what the plan is. I mean, now there are folks out there that understand it's a different plan, and they understand there's some consternation about it, but nobody's seen the plan. And we worked extremely hard since last April, every day until now, working on this plan. And it's very, very significantly enhanced services to both Oakland and Macomb. And,
okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, Lester, I'm in complete agreement. I'd just say the proposition for Mr. Hackle is that fixing existing infrastructure and implementing the automated vehicles of the future are mutually exclusive to a transit plan. I just say,
right,
point of fact.
He brought that up. Driverless cars could take over, and that's a few years off.
I was going to say, I did just disagree. What we need is something that helps people in a 1 and 2 and 5 and 10 year span here and not a 2030 potential.
So assuming the four-county plan is sidelined for the time being, if Washtenaw and Wayne counties go forward with a mass transit link, what might it look like? I mean, we're talking about light rail, rapid transit buses. What is it?
We're looking at all of the options now. And by the way, Detroit would probably be a part of this. So it would be Detroit.
And the counties.
Wayne County, yeah. And Washtenaw. And it's dollar driven. I mean, obviously, the tax base that we would have to work off of, the millage, would have us step it down, but, you know, Andy may have some different feelings, but I think very strongly the link between Detroit and Ann Arbor is a huge piece of it, and light rail to the airport, I think, is something this region significantly needs. And past that, I think that it is short-sighted for the other two counties not to understand the regional value, even if it's not something they're getting on today.
Yeah. Lester, I'd say that sort of the crown jewel of a plan would likely be rail, but people should also remember you have potential for expanded bus service through northeastern Washtenaw into Canton, along essentially the 94 corridor, south down to the airport, and within the various counties in terms of expanded services. So there's a lot of potential, and you know, I think you could look at something that is basically a somewhat modified version of the existing RTA plan between the two counties.
What kind of taxes would be proposed to pay for this?
Well, that's that we're still looking at that, because before we were looking at all four, you know, counties, all four entities in it. But there's another part that's really important too, and is to get an acceptable plan even prior to construction. You've got to be able to get some plans to go into the federal queue to be able to get some federal dollars for the plan. I mean, that doesn't happen the next day. And as long as we keep dawdling around without a plan, we really don't get ourselves in a position to try to attack. And is one of the things I think you could say now is, I mean, we don't just pay a millage. We pay federal taxes, we pay state taxes, we pay taxes. And, you know, I would question why we use federal money to build, you know, highways in Montana when we could be in the queue here and bringing some of that back here. We're certainly a donor state.
Yeah. And, you know, let me just applaud Warren for his leadership on this, because both politically and publicly, but more importantly, practically, from that initial meeting with the governor last spring, he activated his office to take the lead on the logistics of it. Short of that, I don't know if that would have happened. And what Washtenaw County has now done is pass a resolution through our board to direct staff to directly engage on this. And we will see what comes of it. But where we are at now that we have not been before is we've gone from the theoretical discussion of, hey, should we chat about this, to let's look at trying to develop a plan and get it back before us as boards and see, do we want to move on it?
Yeah, one other thing occurs to me, you know, this recent spate of warm weather has revealed all these potholes. People want to put transit money into roads, fixing the roads, getting the Michigan roads back in shape, you know, and your point about sending money to Montana for their highways is taken. But is it going to be difficult to convince people that we need a transit system when they're looking at the road saying, hey, just make sure my commute doesn't mean I blow a tire?
If I can just jump in on this, what would be required is political leadership. And what I think we need to do at all levels is say the state of Michigan needs to fulfill its fundamental responsibility to handle those areas of infrastructure which are under its jurisdiction. Last general election, Washtenaw County put $500,000 on the ballot for road repairs. It passed 70-30. It's not a mutually exclusive proposition. You have to do both. But as long as we have a legislature that is locked into sort of this ideological thinking that you can't invest in infrastructure, it's going to take citizen and civic leadership to say, do your job, fix the roads, and we'll do our part.
I think Andy's right. You know, the other thing is that part of transit now is buses, and buses are hard on the road, but no harder than the trucks that are out there now. But when you evolve into more rapid transit in terms of light rail and that, you're actually taking stress off of the infrastructure. So fixing it today is one thing. Planning for a better balance between the damage to the infrastructure and the ability to move people back and forth is something that's always going to be with us. And I think regional transit helps that proposition.
So if Detroit, Wayne County, and Washtenaw County are serious about pursuing this, what's your next move?
Well, I think, you know, we're going to be talking with Andy regularly in Washtenaw. Those discussions have started. I think what Andy said a little while ago is if we kind of knew we were going to get blindsided a little while ago, we could have stepped up the discussions just that way. But again, I'm not here to beat a dead horse. I think we will certainly engage in trying to see what we can do and try to cost out what the possibilities are within a contained budget that doesn't strain our citizens too badly but gives them value in the mobility.
Yeah. And I think it's really just a question of what existing statutes do you have that you could do it under? What does it look like? How much does it cost? Where does it cover? Getting some meat on that bone and then asking the proposition to the two entities, you know, do you want to go forward? But so far, we haven't even been this far. And so it's exciting in that sense.
We've been talking to Wayne County Executive Warren Evans and the chair of the Washtenaw County Board of Commissioners, Andy LaVar. Gentlemen, thank you for coming in.
Thanks
for having us.
We reached out to Macomb County Executive Mark Hackle. His office expressed interest in joining us for an interview in the future. We offered Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson an interview as well. His office did not get back to us. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin.
Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.